Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, June 15th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. There's actually two cover stories. Following that, I'll read Our World, Reporters on the Job, The Explainer. There's actually two Explainer articles, The Home Forum, and the editorials. So getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled Stories That Show More Than Conflict. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's a print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, the international desk at the Monitor is frequently covering conflict. From Iran to Gaza, from Ukraine to Cuba, our reporters are working to keep readers informed of the news from the world's hotspots. But as this week's magazine shows, they are also doing something else, shining light on the humanity in these places. In our piece from Havana, for instance, reporters Whitney Ulick and Randy Cabrera-Arcia share Cubans' hopes for their country in those individuals' own voices. It's an approach that gives readers an intimate view of the situation facing the island as it runs out of oil, and also the resilience of the people who live there. I want to see Cuba return to its full potential, a joyful, vibrant community with a zest for life, one great-grandmother tells them. When I asked international editor Sarah Miller-Lana about this piece, she explained that these as-told-to vignettes help readers understand that hardships do not define the people who live in troubled parts of the world. All we ever hear about is how Cuba is on the brink of disaster, she told me. It's not that we want to ignore that, because it's an incredibly difficult situation. But if you hear people in their own words, not filtered through our own angles and narratives, it can show the agency that people have. That ties in to staff writer Howard LaFranchi's piece from Ukraine. His story chronicles a young woman who decided to write a book about her experiences in the war there. Sometimes, Sarah says, readers can tune out those living in war because the situation is too difficult for those outside to try to understand. But individuals like Anastasia Fomichova, who was a university student in Paris when she decided to join the fight against Russia for her native Ukraine, counter that inclination. She's clear-eyed and calm, Sarah says, and determined. Other stories this week take a similarly global and nuanced approach. Fred Weir, who regularly helps Western audiences understand life in Vladimir Putin's Russia, writes a counter-narrative about the adaptability of Russians amid what Western leaders describe as the most intense sanctions regime in history. And Gada Abdel Fattah shows in Conflict-Torn Gaza, a quest to save books can bring hope to a community. And that was the From the Editor's column this week, written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor. And this week it was entitled, Stories That Show More Than Conflict. All right, our first cover story is entitled, Voices from Havana. Cubans offer their thoughts about the future of the island. The U.S. government says Cuba is a national security threat. President Donald Trump has even mentioned a friendly takeover of the island. Here's what Cubans, in their own voices, say they want for the future. This is written by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent, and Rudy Cabrera-Arcia, who's a special contributor. From Mexico City and Havana, the situation is difficult for those living in Cuba. Oil reserves on the island have dried up, thanks to the United States' fuel blockade that began in late January. Power outages and food shortages are part of daily life. And the Trump administration is talking about military action and regime change. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, perhaps the loudest voice of the Cuban diaspora in the U.S., has cast doubt on the possibility of a diplomatic resolution, repeatedly telling Cubans that what stands between them and their freedom is the country's leadership. On the heels of the successful capture of Venezuela's former president earlier this year, President Donald Trump said his next focus in the region would be taking Cuba. But what do Cubans want? How eager are they for seismic political change? Also, what aspects of life in Cuba, even under a communist government, do they want to preserve in the future? The Christian Science Monitor spoke with several Cubans living in Havana from their early 30s to their late 80s about the hopes and fears for what comes next on the island. Here are some of their perspectives on this moment in their own voices. A spirit of perseverance. Sheila Rivero, in her early 30s, is a technology specialist in Cuba's state sector. She lives in the capital with her young daughter, alongside her parents, brother, and sister-in-law. She's deeply religious, and a few international travel experiences over the years have made her yearn for a different kind of life in Cuba, replete with freedom, dignity, and possibility, she says. Cuba has always been synonymous with happiness, simplicity, camaraderie, delicious food and music, rhythm in general. But above all, for me, it's characterized by a spirit of perseverance. But that was the Cuba of my past. Today, it's falling apart. It feels sad, lifeless, hopeless. Its music is no longer what it used to be. Marginality has supplanted our rich culture. We no longer get to enjoy our good food. We aren't even cheerful people anymore. And our long history of having a helping spirit is at risk of disappearing into a save-yourself-if-you-can mentality. Everyone is just trying to survive. I like to imagine a prosperous Cuba, healed and restored cities, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, real, truly private enterprises, music made without censorship. As a mother, I want a country where my daughter can dream. I dream of a Cuba where she will want to stay, where she can live on a decent wage. From the government, I want one thing, that it actually works, that politicians are accountable and leaders are chosen through free elections, serve their terms, and actually deliver on their promises. For communism to be something that only lives on in history books. My fear is that all of this from the United States will amount to nothing more than a media spectacle, that whatever agreements are reached will solve absolutely nothing. And what truly terrifies me is the possibility that a bombing could break out here, ultimately claiming the lives of innocent people, especially when you consider that the militarized zones within the city are close to schools, residential areas, and various workplaces. The very essence of being Cuban. Ivan Luis Arcia is an engineer who specializes in metal processing. Several years ago, he started his own car repair business. Though he considers himself an entrepreneur, investing in a piece of private land to set up his workshop, his work still relies on the Cuban government. The way things are now is not how they will remain. I follow the news. A post-Trump Cuban society would be like Switzerland or Costa Rica or Germany, because with the capital that will be invested in Cuba, a country that has the potential to grow exponentially, change will arrive in the blink of an eye. You can ask any Cuban on the street. You don't have to go looking for them. I was at the bank today and there was this really long line and someone shouted, "Hey, we really need Trump to get here already." And everyone started laughing. I mean, we're waiting for the United States. It's an open secret. We have our hopes pinned on Trump. But my fears, I fear that with an economic opening, things like guns and crime could flood in. I also fear that someone like me, who has spent his entire life in Cuba working hard and pushing ahead, might suddenly see someone else arrive with less knowledge but more resources. I'm an engineer. I spent my life studying, yet someone could come along with $40,000 or $50,000 and make an investment that leaves me without the capital to compete. Here I am, someone who stuck it out, and then I'd have to work for them? Anyone with even a little capital is going to grab the biggest slice of the pie. I believe we need to set a quota, not necessarily a hard limit on investments, but specifically on foreign investments. Just consider an average person in the rest of the world and the savings or loans that they have access to. That's the fear, that Cubans might be relegated to the background while some foreigner comes along and leapfrogs right in front of us. If our country ends up parceled out among people who aren't Cuban, the very essence of being Cuban will be lost. Total abandonment. El Chino Libre, a Havana resident of Chinese descent, asked to use his nickname out of fear of reprisals for sharing his feelings about this moment in Cuba. The professional chef tried dabbling in small entrepreneurial restaurant projects over the past decade, but each shuttered, he says, due to arbitrary obstacles and regulations placed on Cuba's small private sector by the government. More recently, he has tried to make ends meet by catering for special events, including at various embassies on the island. Cuba is its people. We're a people who are exhausted. In the past, you might hear people talking about joy and music and the warmth of Cuban people. That's still here, but it's not the same. We have to wake up every day figuring out how to scrape together a meal, survive without electricity. I fear our essence as a people is slowly wearing away. I don't expect saviors, and certainly not saviors coming from outside Cuba. But what is clear to me is that we also can't keep using outside factors as an excuse for everything that's happening here, saying, oh, it's all because of the embargo. That isn't the whole story. My fear is that everything will remain exactly the same way it is and has been, that there will be no change, and that we will continue to justify the unjustifiable here. But I also have hope, including that there will be no way left to keep ignoring our struggles, that things will begin to flow freely. This notion that everyone should have access to health care, to education, it's only fair in theory. It's something that any country, including the United States, should probably aspire to guarantee. But the problem arises when that idea evolves into a system that controls everything. It becomes a system that limits opportunities and prevents growth, and so then it ceases to be real. Access to school or medical care is meaningless if the quality of services are in a state of decay, if doctors, professionals, and teachers lack the proper working conditions. This shouldn't be about idealizing a concept or demonizing it. We have to look at the whole picture. When the power goes out in Cuba, I just sit there, I try to stay calm, and I wait. I start thinking about what this actually represents. When the power goes out, it's not just a blackout. What I feel is total abandonment on the part of my government. And the last one here, a zest for life. Zoila Caridad Gonzalez recently became a great-grandmother. She says she would love to dote on her growing family, but that she spends a large chunk of her time instead standing in line for medicine and state-rationed groceries. She speaks about Cuba as if she's reciting poetry, with rhythm, cadence, and emotion. Idiosyncrasy is the very essence of Cuba. We are gracious hosts. We're sincere. I want to see Cuba return to its full potential, a joyful, vibrant community with a zest for life. What I wish for most is democracy. It's fundamental to any government in the world. Cuba needs urgent change. It needs to uproot communism. The people themselves should decide our future. I have high hopes about the attention from the U.S. I have no concerns. How will the U.S. government go about it? Well, I don't think it could be any worse than this. There's a note here. Whitney Ulick reported from Mexico City and Rudy Cabrera Arcia from Havana. And our next cover story is actually in the books section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, a section I rarely read from. So anyway, we've got this article here. A battlefield volunteer in Ukraine has a story. She wants Europe to hear it. Anastasia Fomichova left her life as a university student in Paris to join the fight for her native Ukraine. She was inspired to write a book testifying to the bravery, resolve, and unflinching humanity of the soldiers she served alongside as a medic. This is written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer. From Kyiv and Kharkiv, Ukraine. When Anastasia Fomichova made the decision in February 2022 to give up her comfortable life as a university student in Paris to join the fight against Russian invaders in her native Ukraine, she did not do so with the intention of writing a book. That would come later. Ms. Fomichova volunteered as a medic with Ukraine's Hospitallers Corps, her service taking her from the post-massacre streets of Bucha outside Kyiv to the terrifying trench warfare of the front lines and to the ultimately successful counter-offensive to liberate Kherson. 7 months later, she knew she had an assignment, a book whose purpose would be twofold. She would bear witness to the bravery, determination, and humanity of the men and women of Ukrainian armed forces she served alongside. And she would issue a warning to all of Europe that the larger war of values she believes Ukraine is fighting, values of freedom, universal human rights, and international law, is also Europe's war. Over the months I spent as a medic in this war, I served alongside so many young, talented, compassionate, and even humorous Ukrainians who had dropped everything and left their families to fight for the security and future of our country, says the diminutive Ms. Fomenchova, who admits she was swimming in over large fatigues, vest, and helmet she was first issued. Their fight for our freedom so impressed me, she adds, that I felt it was my duty to put to words what I had experienced with them. But that was only half her objective. Seated outdoors at a cafe just a few dozen yards down the hill from Kyiv's historic St. Michael's Golden Domed Monastery, she says much of Europe has been slow to grasp the threat it faces. I also wanted this book to be a warning to Europeans that this war is their war, too, she says. The Ukraine that Vladimir Putin would destroy is fundamentally European. It's the Ukraine that aspires to European values. Her family's trials. The bells of St. Michael's begin to chime, and Ms. Fomichova smiles. The monastery is where she first bivouacked after arriving from Paris just days after Russia launched its full-scale invasion, February 24, 2022. It is those values that Putin detests above all and which he will never stop trying to destroy. It's why even seizing all of Ukraine would not be enough for him, she adds, and this is what I want Europe to understand. In her book, Ms. Fomichova chronicles her own family's experience as an effective way of putting beating hearts into the complicated and often painful history of Ukraine in the Soviet Union and then as the prey of a revanchist Russia. She writes of the Holodomor, the 1932-33 famine Stalin engineered to kill millions of Ukrainians. She covers the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear reactor accident in Soviet Ukraine, a disaster that ultimately prompted her mother to take her daughter and move to France. In one early captivating scene in the book, she describes how a young girl she discovered newspaper clippings recounting the mysterious killings in Moscow of her grandmother and grandfather, her grandfather having been security chief to Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, and Mr. Khrushchev himself was from Ukraine. Ms. Fomichova, who grew up in France and attended French universities, wrote in her book in French. But for its title, she chose the Ukrainian word V-O-L-I-A, which means both will and liberty. V-O-L-I-A is one of more than 1,300 war-related books that have been published since Russia seized the Crimean Peninsula and occupied pro-Russian sections of Ukraine's eastern Donbas region in 2014. A surprising number of those have, like V-O-L-I-A, come out in the 4+ years since the full-scale invasion. They include journals, books of poetry, works of nonfiction like V-O-L-I-A, and fiction. For Ms. Fomichova, this literary burst is explained at least partly by the fact that so many early volunteers in the fight against Russia's invasion were among Ukraine's most brilliant, as she calls them, young entrepreneurs, engineers, doctors, writers, musicians, artists, people imbued with a creative spirit, she says, many of whom were veterans of the pro-democracy and pro-Europe Maidan Revolution of 2014 that helped solidify Ukrainian identity. Enduring interest in history, culture. Book publishing of all kinds surged in Ukraine after February 2022 as Ukrainians sought both escape from the war through romance and fantasy novels, for example, and deeper insight into the national identity that Russia under President Putin seems set on erasing. More recently, the fervor for books has cooled, says Charkiv publisher Oleksandr Sevchuk. He says war fatigue and even the lack of electricity over winter months have deflated an enthusiasm for reading. But at the same time, he says, interest in the kinds of books that Savak Publishing produces, historical works focused on Ukraine's past, its folk art, and lost cultural heritage, has not waned. And he believes the numbers suggest interest in works about the war also remains strong. What I think the growing number of titles related to the war underscores, especially as book sales and overall publishing numbers decline, is just how deeply and permanently the war has marked our existence, Mr. Savchak says. The Kharkiv publisher says he's about to find out how enduring interest in works about the war is. He has just published a Ukrainian translation of the journal of a young German woman, Savita Wagner, who also volunteered to serve as a medic in Ukraine, in part to compensate for what she felt was her own country's inadequate support for Ukraine's freedom. She was killed in a war, but the journal she kept of her wartime experience was published in German. Mr. Savchak was approached at last year's Frankfurt Book Fair by Ms. Wagner's mother, who was seeking a Ukrainian publisher to make her daughter's story and commitment to Ukraine's freedom available to the Ukrainian people. I don't publish many contemporary works, he notes, but I became convinced that this journal by a foreigner who died for Ukraine should be accessible to Ukrainians. Savchak Publishing presented the Ukrainian translation at the Kyiv International Book Arsenal Festival in May. The Humanity War Reveals. Ms. Fomichova's VOLA won France's prestigious André Malraux Prize last year, which might seem like a pinnacle achievement. But on a recent stroll through the grounds of St. Michael's Monastery, past a threshold she had crossed on what she describes as the dark days of Russia's assault on Kyiv, Ms. Fomichova describes her ambitions. She hopes the work will soon be translated into Ukrainian. Now, a visiting professor of international humanitarian law at the National University of Kyiv, Mohyla Academy, she hopes her work will one day provide evidence for the war crime trials she believes Russia should face. But perhaps most of all, she says she hopes her book serves as a testimony to the bravery, resolve, and unflinching humanity of the soldiers she served alongside as they face inhumane forces. She recounts the legendary tale she had heard of medics who, out of desperation, conducted blood transfusions directly from their own arms to that of dying soldiers. She describes being frozen with fear in a frontline trench, under heavy fire when a Ukrainian soldier she had never seen before dies in beside her, and seeing her state, takes her hand and declares, "Everything is going to be okay." All of which leads Ms. Fomichova to an observation that the literature of war has drawn on for millennia. War shows us the worst of times, even as it exposes exquisite moments of friendship and solidarity and love, she says. War reveals man's darkest moments, she says, but in it we can also see among the most illuminating moments in human life. There's a bullet here. It says, Oleksandr Nasalenko supported reporting for this project. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. And here's the first one. Kremlin-sponsored security forum debuts. The first international security forum, which wrapped up May 29th near Moscow, was designed to rival the Munich Security Conference as a key arena for foreign policy debate and geopolitical strategy discussions. Sponsored by the Kremlin Security Council, the forum featured an agenda with topics such as global multipolarity, countering neocolonialism, and traditional values. The four-day event drew almost 5,000 participants from 120 mostly Russia-friendly or neutral countries, but also featured 12 unofficial participants from countries considered unfriendly to Russia. That was written by Fred Weir. And the next one. A year in orbit pushes both hardware and humans. That's how Australia-based astrophysicist Richard de Grieg speaking to Agence France-Presse, described China's recently launched Shenzhou 23 space mission. The mission, in which a Chinese astronaut will spend a year in orbit, inches China closer to its 2030 lunar landing goal and could help Beijing's space program build knowledge and experience to compete with NASA. Besides studying the physical effects of long-term spaceflight, the crew will conduct experiments in material sciences and microgravity physics. And that was from Lindsay McGinnis. And the next one, an option for Eid sacrifices. In late May, Muslims around the world mark Eid al-Adha by slaughtering sheep and cattle and distributing the meat to their families, communities, and people in need. But in Egypt, economic pressures have pushed the price of the animals so high that many families can't afford them. A growing number are paying charities in Tanzania, where sheep are about a tenth of the price, to sacrifice an animal on their behalf, reports the Connecticut, an African newspaper. That was from Ryan Lenora Brown. And the last one here, purple rains in Mexico City. Intersections, the light rail cars, and apartment building facades in Mexico City are awash in purple paint and images of the country's beloved axolotl, a type of salamander native to the capital's ancient waterways. Locals express frustration over using limited resources to plaster the city with shades of lilac and the face of this seemingly smiling amphibian as part of capital-wide beautification efforts ahead of the World Cup. Many residents say funds could have been used to repave roads or update security cameras, but Mexico City Mayor Clara Brugada has stood behind her purpleification of the megacity. President Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo weighed in too. The bridges look very pretty. And that was written by Whitney Ulick. It's got a little note here. Have an idea for Our World? Please email ourworld@csps.com if there is an important global story that the media missed, a trend that is driving the news where you live, or a story that uplifts. The Monitor will publish readers' picks from time to time. And now for reporters on the job in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it, and then a paragraph or two about each one. The first one is from Latonia, Kentucky, and it is written by Scott Baldoff. In Kentucky, poll access for reporters largely depends on the local officials working the site. Activists and campaigners are required to stay 100 feet away from the polls, but in theory, election observers and reporters can get closer as long as they let people cast their votes unimpeded. At one polling center, a stern-looking official strode over to me and photographer Melanie Stetson Freeman to tell us that activists were not allowed any closer. We explained that we were journalists hoping to learn what qualities voters wanted to see in their leaders. The poll official waved us forward. We spoke to one gentleman who hugged a relative he had noticed and started asking her the questions I had just posed to him. The politics were different, but he kept saying, "We're family. There's just love here." The next one is from Memphis, Tennessee, and it's written by Patrick Johnson. I was on a reporter's quest to understand the impacts of AI data centers on communities. In southwest Memphis sits Colossus One, an AI data center that has for the past year housed Grok, the product of one of Elon Musk's companies. There, under low, dark clouds joined by smokestack emissions, the 300-megawatt Colossus hummed. The contrast between looming, razor-wire-encircled industry and the humble human community below felt Tolkien-esque. The data center is housed in an old appliance factory now ringed by natural gas turbines. Nearby residents complain of adverse effects from the acrid fumes, and I was witnessing the energy-hungry reality at the center of the AI revolution. The next one's from Atlanta and written by Simon Montlake. While reporting a story about the emergence of U.S. soccer fandom, I encountered folks with high passion, patriotic costumes, and boisterous chants. But ahead of the World Cup, in the parking lot before one U.S. men's national team game in Atlanta against Portugal, I found fans of a different type as well. When I went to investigate a group of people wearing Portugal jerseys, I discovered they were extras in a commercial that a U.S. tech company would be filming during the game. It was a reminder that the World Cup, the world's most watched sporting event, is a commercial juggernaut. And the last one here. It's from Odessa, Ukraine, and it's written by Sarah Miller Lana, an international editor, and it's about Howard LaFranchi, who works for the Christian Science Monitor. Howard LaFranchi was in the port city of Odessa recently reporting about Ukraine's drone diplomacy. After more than 4 years of war, Howard says many Ukrainians barely flinch at the sound of incoming fire or at the noise of the country's defense systems working. But as he walked near the Potokin Stairs, the setting of a scene from the 1925 Soviet film Battleship Potokin, in which Tsarist soldiers shoot a mother, causing her baby carriage to tumble down the steps intact, he heard the sound of incoming drones. He looked around and noticed one person running to avoid debris, a woman pushing a stroller. He had a brief moment to reflect on how history repeats itself. Wow, I thought, 101 years after that movie, and here's a woman with a baby carriage running. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, there are two articles in the explainer, and they're both talking about sanctions. So the first one, what do sanctions achieve? The answer is complex. Sanctions have been a go-to geopolitical tool in the West for decades. But as sanctioned countries such as Russia and Iran keep pursuing their goals, many wonder, do sanctions work? This is written by Mark Sappenfield, who is a senior global correspondent, and Whitney Ulick and Fred Weir, who are special correspondents. From Berlin, Mexico City, and Moscow, given the state of the world, one might reasonably wonder what sanctions actually accomplish. The United States has had sanctions on Iran in one form or another since the Islamic Revolution there in 1979, and Iran is still strong enough to defy American and Israeli airstrikes and hold the global economy ransom in the Strait of Hormuz. In Europe, sanctions have had no discernible effect on Russia's determination to wage war in Ukraine. And a military operation was needed to remove President Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela, despite more than 20 years of sanctions aimed at reshaping that country's political order. At a time of big power politics, sanctions have a certain appeal. We're in a world that likes coercive tools, whether they work or not, says Penny Nass, a sanctions expert at the German Marshall Fund of the United States in Washington. But do sanctions just make the nations who apply them feel like they're doing something? Looking at Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, there are clear lessons about when sanctions work and when they don't, and the rules can at times seem counterintuitive. Sanctions against airplane engine parts? Probably effective. Freezing oligarchs' assets? Perhaps not. There is something of a playbook for effective sanctions, but politics and emotion mean nations often get them wrong and then find it hard to change course. What follows is a question and answer piece. Question: when are sanctions effective? Answer: if there is a golden rule for sanctions, it is this. Know what you want to accomplish and then use targeted sanctions for a limited amount of time to achieve that defined goal. The danger is in setting too ambitious a goal. For example, sanctions alone will never bring about regime change. Venezuela and Iran are proof of that. They were also never going to get Russia to change course in Ukraine. The U.S. sanctions imposed on Venezuela were intended to move the country toward free and fair elections, says Kerry Filippetti, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cuba and Venezuela in the State Department's Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs. Ultimately, that was not a success, but there is evidence that after sanctions were loosened, the regime of Nicolas Maduro tightened its authoritarian grip. When I look at that, it's not to say that sanctions made Venezuela free. Ms. Filippetti says, but you can see that they did seem to constrain some of the authoritarian impulses of the Maduro regime in ways that the release of sanctions did not. The same is true in Russia. The U.S. and European Union sanctions have not forced Russia to abandon its war in Ukraine, but that was not the only goal. They have caused economic trouble for Moscow. Interest rates are currently near 15%, largely to control inflation, which is running at about 6%. Moreover, sanctions on Russian oil exports have significantly decreased oil revenue. Not only is Russia being forced to sell its oil to other buyers at a significant discount, it has also had to build a shadow fleet of ships that can deliver oil around the world without detection from international regulatory bodies. This has come at a significant price, both the cost of the fleet and the inefficiencies inherent of skirting international law. One estimate suggests these ships see a 30% decline in productivity. With oil revenue central to the Russian economy, Russian government budgets have dipped into deficit spending. While this might be common in the West, it is unprecedented in the fiscally conservative era of President Vladimir Putin. Rising deficits has caused Moscow to prepare a list of spending cuts, tax increases, and other measures to cover the gap. But the Iran war, with its spike in global oil prices, has allowed Russia to avoid those choices for now. The question is, has the economic hardship caused by sanctions been enough to act as a deterrent to Russia in the future? Some say the sanctions have been effective in that regard. I don't believe you can force Putin to change policy, but as a means of deterring Russia, you can hardly make it work better, says Alexander Kolyander, a Russian expert at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And the next question, when do sanctions not work? And the next answer, others say that the somewhat unfocused and long-term nature of the Russian sanctions means the country has essentially sanction-proofed itself. This is the potential danger of sanctions. If not targeted and temporary, they can in some ways help the country they seek to punish. Sanctions have accelerated Russia's turn to China, India, Africa, and other countries to establish lasting partnerships with countries of the non-West, says Dmitry Suslov, an international affairs expert at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. And while sanctions have increased costs and forced workarounds, he adds they have also made some sectors of the Russian economy more agile, and the economy as a whole is more diverse and resilient than it was before sanctions. For example, when you remove furniture retailer IKEA from Russia, as sanctions did, Russian manufacturers as a result have more space to grow and innovate to meet market demand. Or when you target oligarchs' financial holdings abroad, you encourage them to invest their money at home instead. They pushed all Russian capital stored abroad back into Mother Russia, says Dr. Kolyander. The West helped Putin rally them around the flag and make them invest domestically. The years immediately following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine saw a domestic investment boom. Far more effective are sanctions on things that Russia needs but cannot easily replace, such as advanced aviation parts or semiconductors. By contrast, allowing Russian billionaires to keep their wealth abroad or to vacation in Saint-Tropez is not always a good look with Western voters politically, even if it hurts Russia economically. It is usually politically toxic, says Dr. Kolyander. You can be accused of playing into Putin's hands. Perhaps the hardest thing to achieve through sanctions is also the most important, buy-in from the international community. Most experts cite the Obama administration's sanctions on Iran as among the more successful, but they took years to assemble. The clear goal was to move Iran back to the negotiating table regarding its nuclear program, and the effort won the backing even of Russia and China. That meant Iran had nowhere to turn, at least not until Mr. Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal in 2018, effectively shelving it and reopening doors for Tehran. That was never the case in Venezuela. There are lots of mechanisms for countries to evade sanctions these days, specifically because of the behavior of malign actors like China, Russia, and Iran, who are constantly helping each other bust U.S. sanctions, says Ms. Filippetti, now a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington. Sanctions work much more when they're not just U.S. sanctions, but there are also sanctions from the European Union and the United Nations. And the final question, who ends up feeling the brunt of sanctions? And the final answer, by one measure, U.S. sanctions against Venezuela did have a devastating effect. According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, sanctions placed in 2019 on PDVSA, Venezuela's state-run oil and gas company, played a key role in the Venezuelan economy shrinking by more than one-third that year and by one-quarter the following year. We thought, well, if we deprive the regime of the resources that it needs to govern, then it will choose to negotiate, says Ms. Filippetti. But really, the only resources they needed were resources that they could use to pay off their loyalists. They didn't care about governing, and so we had underestimated their willingness to sacrifice their own people in order to keep themselves in power. Research suggests that smaller countries are more vulnerable to sanctions, especially those that are so dependent on exports. But if they are willing to rule by intimidation, broad sanctions become less effective. Cuba, long subject to debilitating U.S. sanctions, is an even starker example. What is amazing to me is that supporters of the U.S. embargo on Cuba always say Cuba is a cruel and repressive government, says Christopher Sabatini, senior fellow for Latin America at Chatham House, a London-based think tank. But if they are so cruel, why do they let people protest and overthrow them? They don't care about human suffering. Their interest is in their own survival. This underlines a key point. Sanctions are only one tool. Problems arise when sanctions simply drag on or are not used in concert with other efforts to reach an achievable outcome. In Russia, the sanctions did have an initial sharp effect, says Elena Rabakova, a sanctions expert at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, but that was never exploited by other means. Had those initial sanctions been paired with military action, she says, Russia might have been significantly weakened. The complementary action doesn't have to be military, but it has to be something, Ms. Rybakova says. Ultimate success is in coordinating all these measures. And our next explainer article is under the heading of Sanctions Explainer. Russia, a case study for sanctions not working as planned. If there's any country that shows sanctions unforeseen consequences, it's one that has rebuilt self-sufficiency and forged new trade under pressure. This is written by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent. From Moscow, when Western leaders levied what has been described as the most intense sanctions regime in history against Russia, starting in 2014 and intensifying after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, they expected big effects. Results like economic sectors that were dependent on Western expertise being forced to shut down, or at least to revert to more primitive forms of activity. Instead, something unexpected happened. More than 4 years after Western suppliers cut them off, millions of Russian drivers are still tooling around in American, European, or Japanese cars. Russian airlines continue flying their estimated 500 or so Boeing and Airbus planes. Russian energy producers manage to keep exploring and drilling for oil and gas. The Russian economy has rewired itself, developed alternatives for many of the Western goods it was suddenly deprived of, or in many cases found illegal ways of acquiring them. It rerouted supply chains and courted new markets. Where 15 years ago Russia's biggest trading partner was the European Union, which bought Russian energy and sold back the full range of consumer goods, today new pipelines carry Russian oil and gas to China. Instead of the empty shop shelves that many predicted, the same range of goods is available but now are mostly homemade substitutes or from countries that refuse to join the sanctions regime, mostly in Asia. Even if the war in Ukraine ended tomorrow, the changes wrought by sanctions on the configuration of Russia's economy, its relations with other countries, and arguably the shape of the global economic order look permanent. Sanctions do have an impact. They damage and distort normal market relations, says Ivan Timofeev, director of the Russian International Affairs Council, a government-founded diplomatic think tank in Moscow. No one denies that it's very stressful, but Russia has largely adapted. By redirecting trade and reshaping domestic economic relations, we've survived. Diversification thanks to sanctions. After growing robustly in the early years of the war, thanks to massive state military spending, Russia's economy has begun slowing down. Still, the International Monetary Fund predicts it will grow by 1.1% this year, which, ironically, is more than is forecast for major nations that are sanctioning Russia, including France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The structural economic changes wrought by war and sanctions have been sweeping, but the political shift may prove equally durable. Russia's foreign policy priority in the first decade of Vladimir Putin's reign was to improve relations with Europe. In recent years, China has become Moscow's key geopolitical partner, and it has poured resources into building alternative Russia-friendly associations of states such as the BRICS. BRICS. Russia does not view sanctions as some sort of punishment for our supposed sins. We perceive sanctions as economic warfare waged against us with the purpose of destruction, says Dmitry Suslov, an expert with the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Russia has come to view the West not merely as unreliable partners, but as adversaries bent on destroying us. The impact of sanctions has produced portentous surprises, such as Russia's massive trade surplus with longtime partner India, about $600 billion last year, which has the potential to reshape Indo-Russian relations permanently. India's currency controls make it difficult for Russian companies to repatriate their profits, so talks are underway to find mechanisms to either increase Indian exports to Russia or allow Russia to invest its growing stack of rupees into India. We've never had trade with Russia like we have today, says Nandan Unikrishnan, an expert with the Observer Research Foundation, a Delhi-based think tank. It's mainly down to oil, but the increase has been exponential. Mr. Unikrishnan says the devil is in the details, but the potential for a deeper Indo-Russian economic partnership is improving. It would be a good thing if the economic relationship became more diversified and might balance Russia's drift into China's embrace, he says. Greater Russian and Chinese bonds. For its part, China has learned to insulate its banks and businesses from the threat of secondary sanctions for doing business with Russia, and the recent blockade of the Strait of Hormuz appears to have focused Chinese minds on the benefits of building new energy pipelines from Russia to avoid such maritime choke points. China is largely self-sufficient in energy, but they've made it clear that they are ready to absorb as much oil and gas as Russia can supply, says Sergei Sazonov, an expert with the Official Institute of China and Contemporary Asia in Moscow. The U.S.-led war in Iran appears to have accelerated many developments that were already underway, which will make the world a more comfortable place for Russia. That includes diversification of trading partners and efforts to establish payment systems that avoid the use of the dollar. The public discussion in India since the Iran war started is very clear, says Mr. Unikrishnan. We need to reassess our relations with the U.S. and be sure to maintain our good ties with countries like Russia and not put all our eggs into any one basket. Even if President Donald Trump goes, the unreliable nature of the U.S. is likely to remain. And now we find ourselves in a home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. They've got one article, and here it is. The Universal Language of a Smile. Persistence and instant connection create lasting joy in our staff photographers' images from the people of Côte d'Ivoire. And this is written by, who is it written by? Melanie Stetson Freeman. I love collecting faces in my camera and bringing them home with me. Faces are like snowflakes. No two are alike. I recently visited Côte d'Ivoire for the first time. Every new country has a learning curve for me, since folks in faraway places react differently to the camera. After visiting for a while in the country, I noticed that Ivoirians had resting faces that looked rather closed and stern. I wondered, were they not happy to see me? But after a connection was made, maybe just eye contact, wait for it, beautiful smiles broke out again and again. When I travel on assignment for the Monitor, one of the best parts of my job is peeking behind the curtain of a country. It's not like being on vacation, because I get to meet and spend a little time with our subjects, sometimes visiting their homes or businesses. I see places not listed on tourist itineraries. Other times, I come across people for just a quick impression when I look out the window of our passing car or walk by them on my way to somewhere else. That's what these images represent. Oh, twins! Of all the frames I shot in Côte d'Ivoire, the photos I took of these two wonderful men are my favorites, and there's a picture of them at the top. Our connection was instant. They immediately gave me permission to snap their picture. They were thrilled. Their smiles, their joy, their love for each other, it was all there. They had been sitting together outside a tailor's atelier that I was photographing. Did they live nearby? Did they always sit there? I don't know. I don't even know their names, but they made me smile when I met them, and they make me smile every time I look at the portrait. The children live in a tiny village near Cocoa Farms. We stopped our car for a moment on the way back to the capital. They were right outside my window. Click! In the photo, one looks surprised, another not sure, one with a shy smile, and the boy, like little boys everywhere, has a gesture with a pose to match. Later, looking out from a shop, I saw this football club warming up before a scrimmage. A couple of players spotted me with my long lens and reacted. Other players kept running, unaware. I never know what I'll encounter on a photo shoot, but I try to be ready for anything. A cook was grilling fish for the lunchtime crowd at a small restaurant in the capital, Abidjan. While the Monitor reporter was doing an interview there, I kept going over to the cook to capture just the right moment. She laughed when I came back multiple times. I did get her name, Miriam Cohn. As with all my work trips, I am tasked with illustrating stories through my lens that a writer is reporting. In addition, I'm always on the lookout for other images that move me. I don't speak French, so in Côte d'Ivoire, I relied on our fluent correspondent and our local fixer, Albane, who helped us find what we needed. Still, there were many moments on my own, and I interacted without language, using my smile and a slight lift of my camera that said, "Can I take your photo?" Usually the answer was, "Yes." And finally, we're in the editorial section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, and here's the first one, "Freeing Cuba Without Revenge." For months, the Trump administration has aimed various types of punishing force at the regime in Havana to free the Cuban people. An oil blockade, criminal charges against the dominant leader, Raul Castro, the deployment of an aircraft carrier and a strike group in the Caribbean Sea, hinting at an invasion. Much of this strategy has been driven by influential Cuban Americans who have long sought retribution against the island's communist rulers who took over in 1959. It will be difficult to completely control the impulse for revenge that some Cubans may feel during a transition, an opposition leader, Jose Daniel Ferrer, told Cuban news outlet 14E Medio in January. Yet another force might be strengthening among the political opposition, one that could erode the regime from within, official by official. It entails ridding oneself of thoughts of revenge, and as respected dissident and former political prisoner Oscar Elias Bisset puts it, loving one's adversaries. I have acquired the capacity to love them because in this way we do away with violence, wrath, vengeance, hatred, and substitute them with justice and forgiveness, Dr. Bisset wrote in 1999. As Dr. Bisset's ideas have become more widely accepted among Cubans, they are seen as key to laying the groundwork for democracy. We are not going to build a fraternal, humane, prosperous, and civilized Cuba on the basis of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, Mr. Ferrer said. Because, as someone already said, we would all end up blind and toothless. Practical loving of one's enemies. During his more than 12 years as a political prisoner, Mr. Furr found out the practical side of loving one's enemies and how it dissipates the fear that is the regime's glue. His genuine affection for military officers and others who ran the prison led them to open up about him, about their dislike of the government. He told them, "Our fight was also for them and their families. I told them there's no intentions of settling scores or seeing them as enemies to be persecuted." When you get to know the police officer, the soldier, the civil servant, when you establish trust with them and guarantee that what they say won't be overheard, you reach one conclusion. The regime has no one who supports it. Truth-telling and forgiveness for accountability. For many seeking democracy in Cuba, being kind to one's adversaries does not mean there will not be accountability for those who committed the worst atrocities. Yet when so many Cubans have supported the regime in one way or another, the line between victims and perpetrators has become blurred. Some mix of truth-telling and forgiveness is needed. Or as Joe Garcia, a Cuban-American and former U.S. House member from Florida, told the On Cuba news outlet, "Justice implies the future. Revenge doesn't. Revenge doesn't care what happens the next day." Well, we got less than a minute left, so I'll jump over to the numbers in the news column. 53, that's the number of U.S. states, territories, and districts that introduced legislation related to artificial intelligence in the 2025 legislature session. From Puerto Rico to the U.S. Capitol, AI has increasingly been used in government in areas ranging from customer service to safety and inspections. According to a 2024 study, 51% of all levels of government reported using AI multiple times a week, if not daily. And 21, that's the number of students in the 2026 Jericho High School class in Long Island, New York, who were named valedictorian. Each student earned straight A's in every class over the course of 4 years, and they credited years of hard work and sacrifice. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.